The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Now, as part of a special interview arranged by the Marine Institute, I recently caught up with Irish-American geologist, former NASA astronaut Kathy Sullivan, to talk about her long and fascinating career. She was the first American woman to take a spacewalk. She was part of the mission that deployed the Hubble telescope. Not alone that, after she left NASA, she went back to her first career ambition, marine exploration, and she got to go to the deepest place in the oceans, Challenger Deep in the Pacific, more than 35,000 feet below sea level, where the pressure is 120 times that on the Earth's surface. What an amazing life story. On the line from the US, I started by asking Kathy what had inspired her to become an astronaut.
Well, I had certainly watched the astronauts growing up. That would have been starting when I was about 10. And at the same time, of course, Jacques Cousteau, a very intrepid explorer, was pushing back the frontiers of the oceans and revealing all of that to us on television magazines. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I saw in the lifestyles and the adventures and the inquisitiveness that lay behind the astronaut program and Cousteau as well. I was enthralled by that. I mean, what exciting, interesting, you know, always curious lives they had. So I knew I wanted that, whatever that chemistry is that lets your life be the lives I was seeing. I didn't know what you called something that let you have a life like that. But when I was around 10 or 11 years old, I recognized and discovered with the help of a family friend that I had a certain flair for languages. So my first theory, if you will, my first game plan for how do I get to be inquisitive and curious and learn all about the earth was, well, bank on a talent for languages and then build from there and see where it can take you.
Now, that's what you went to college to do languages. But happily, I suppose, for all of us, there was a need to take electives. Now, I know when I was doing scientific subjects in Georgia Tech, I had to take artistic or arts electives. You had to take, as a linguist, you had to take scientific electives. And there was the turning point.
Yeah, very much so. I argued heartily against needing to fulfill that requirement for three courses in the first year. And I will agree with you happily. I lost all those arguments. I had a French advisor who had scouted out classes that were, you know, interesting, well taught, and not too hard for language majors to pass. So he recommended three, and two of them happened to be marine science courses. First, a broad sweep in marine biology that was aimed at both people who would major in the field and the likes of me, and then my final term of that year, a broad oceanography course. The professors in both cases were quite young profs. They couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 years into their teaching career. So you're really not that much older than those of us that were in their classes. They were energetic. They were dynamic. They were passionate about their subjects. And every weekend they were trucking us off down to the shore or up into the mountains to actually do geology and do biology. You see something we'd never encountered before. And instead of running to a textbook to look up what it means and get the right answer, helping us learn how to observe and think and reason and, as I say, build an answer to something new instead of just go looking one up. It was exactly the kind of vibrant, energetic experience that I remembered having seen in Cousteau and the astronauts. So, you know, I compared the likely pathways of a linguist who wanted to travel to lots of places and the likely pathway of a geologist or oceanographer. Someone was always buying these people airline tickets to go off and study a mountain or join a ship somewhere. I decided I'm going with them.
Now, that could have been your career, but even before you graduated, there was an ad for female astronaut candidates because the shuttle program was being developed and you applied. Did you have any real expectation or was it just one of those things? They're looking for females. I'm a female. I'll apply.
Well, I was urged to apply by my brother who kept saying there can't be that many 26-year-old PhDs in the female PhDs in the world. Try. The penny dropped when I stopped thinking about how impossible it would be to do my kind of oceanography from orbital altitudes and recognized the job NASA was hiring for was basically expedition manager in a sense. The shuttle, when I conceived of the shuttle as a research ship in space, then it made sense to me, and I could make some really useful comparisons with all the research expeditions I had done at sea, starting my fourth year of university. I loved the expeditionary part of oceanography, planning them, going out to sea, continuously adapting to what life throws at you. It's never quite what you had in your plan. I was good at it and knew I loved it. And NASA was looking for that skill set to apply on a research vessel that would go into orbit. Then the question was, well, but why else would you really want to shift gears and go in that direction? And for me, that was a very simple answer. If somehow I beat all the numerical odds and got selected out of the thousands that would apply, I would actually get to look back at Earth from orbit with my own eyes instead of forever in my life studying other astronauts' pictures. And that part was just irresistible.
Now, I've been reading in your book, which is called Handprints on Hubble, but it does seem as if you were almost born to this, because even when you're trying to create the weightless environment on Earth, and then when you go into space, it just seemed, well, reading your book, it seems like you felt absolutely at home.
Well, I did, and I can't quite explain that. It's my curiosity just tends to propel me into things, and I stay very immersed in them. Certainly my first few moments, my first day probably in orbit on my first flight, I was just as zero G clumsy as every rookie is. You've not gotten quite accustomed yet to how gentle and refined your movements want to be. Anyone on the broadcast who's ever hopped in the ocean and scuba dived will remember the same thing of first sort of flailing about a bit and then over time smoothing out your motions and becoming really quite graceful underwater. You have the same thing happen when you're adjusting to zero gravity. Another part of it is the training and preparation you do either before you head out to sea or before you go off on a space mission. You've made yourself so deeply familiar with the ship, with the craft, with how it works, with where your gear is going to be, with how it's all set up. So it's a very novel experience once you get underway. But you built all that. It's not like you suddenly plopped into it as a passenger. You've been working a long time preparing and building all of this. And so it is quite familiar to you when you set off.
The countdown, I would imagine, as a non-astronaut, it would be terrifying and intimidating and so on. It's not how you describe it, though. And occasionally when the countdown has had to stop, it's a matter of irritation to the astronauts. There's no relief there at all. You just want to get out of the Earth's atmosphere, get up there. But even the first launch, I mean, was there any sense of being scared at all?
I was just eager to go. We've been training and preparing for such a long time to do this. And there are so many, so many glitches, so many events external to your flight that can trip up your schedule and delay you again and again. So it takes a lot of patience and perseverance to get to the point that you're suited up and going out to the launch pad. I think we were all just eager to get on and start to reap the yield of all the investments that we and the scientists whose equipment we were carrying, the huge team that's made a huge investment to get to that point. And you really want to go forward and fulfill it.
Now, I mentioned the Hubble telescope, which is the real subject matter of your book. And the idea of a Hubble telescope being a telescope that didn't exist on Earth, because the atmosphere of the Earth kind of gets in the way of clarity of the pictures. So whose idea was it and how did it come to pass?
First idea of putting a telescope in orbit is credited to a German researcher named Hermann Oberth back in the late 1920s. No one had the engineering skill or capacity at that point to make that any kind of real prospect. But it was visionaries in the science fiction sense. It comes back again in 1946, thanks to a Princeton astronomer named Lyman Spitzer. As the Second World War was winding down, the White House in the United States asked leading scientists, what should we now do with this capacity that was built to win the war? There were rockets and airplanes and a vast mobilization of talent. Should we just let that all go back to what it had been doing before? Should we apply it to some new purposes? And Lyman picked up the idea again of a telescope in space, which now could just about be realized with the engineering capability, and laid out a very detailed case, how big the mirror should be, what that would let you do, what kind of instruments, and why would that be worthwhile in terms of not just understanding stars and galaxies beyond the Earth, but also understanding the Earth's own atmosphere.
The Hubble is the size of a school bus, I learned from your book, weighs 11,000 kilos or more. Yeah. It's a hell of a payload to get into space, and then you've got to deploy its solar wings to power it and all of that. It's just a magnificent technical achievement.
It was a remarkable technical achievement. That the cadre of people that designed Hubble, I was stunned as I did the research for the book, absolutely floored at how precise and insightful their foresight was. They're really laying the groundwork for Hubble in the middle 1960s. Well, there almost isn't a space age yet in the middle 1960s. The engineers that are starting the process of making this magical telescope, their engineering background was at best in airplanes. Mostly it was in cars and motorcycles. And yet they're thinking ahead with such clarity to this thing that has never existed before. What does it need to be able to do? And just as importantly, we've got to design its layout so that astronauts in big, bulky spacesuits can actually go repair it like the mechanic can repair your car. But at the time they're imagining that, there have only ever been two spacewalks done in the world, and they both were near disasters. I mean, the Russian cosmonaut really almost did die because no one really knew how to set up all the practicalities so that a spacewalker could do meaningful work. But here are these guys nonchalantly say, oh yeah, school bus size, no problem. And maintainable, sure, swap out instruments, do this and that. These guys in these big bulky spacesuits, yeah, we can do that. It was just amazing. It took 20 some years just to get it built and tested and ready to be taken to orbit in the space shuttle.
It was finally deployed and you were involved in that deployment. And then you get back to Earth and it's, you know, terrific, great. And then it's switched on and the pictures are blurry. With what kind of dismay was that greeted?
Oh, it was a really crushing day for NASA, certainly. This multi-billion-dollar instrument that's been getting worked on forever, at huge community of astronomers eager to have it work. And they tried every bit of focusing trick they could and finally had to realize that the 2.4-meter diameter, 8-meter diameter, 8-foot diameter mirror was ever so slightly the wrong shape. And it was at first just crushing. A huge disappointment. And of course, the press and comedians and members of Congress just jumped all over NASA. How could you make such a fundamental mistake on such an important payload? So it was a very dark time. And it really did seem for a while there that this could be a fatal blow to NASA. Remember, it's just a couple of years after the loss of the Space Shuttle Challenger, NASA's reputation is still sort of being redeemed from that horrible accident. And now you've mucked up this thing.
The headline from Newsweek was NASA's $1.5 billion blunder, which, you know, puts it in a very stark headline for ordinary people to understand. But of course, the scientists, they got together and they realized this is a problem that can be solved by optics. And they designed something that corrected the Hubble.
The problem is correct the light that bounces off the big mirror. And so that's where they took advantage of the maintenance capability. They already had large scientific instruments that were built to intercept the light and shine it onto their detectors. Let's take one of them out. And in its place, let's install the optics that will correct the light and fix it for all the other instruments. And then in the years after, that fix was put in 1993. In later years, on later repair missions, the astronauts, the engineers would build that correction into each new instrument. So the optics were corrected as the new instruments went up.
Now, what an extraordinary career in space. But, you know, all good things must come to an end. And another opportunity came your way. And from a woman who's described as her deepness, for you to actually change direction. And instead of going up, to go down. What happened?
Well, Sylvia Earle is the woman who's often referred to as her deepness. She's a revered and renowned marine ecologist and a longtime friend of mine at that point. She was serving as chief scientist of our National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. a broad agency that covers everything from weather forecasting to fisheries management. And the time had come, for family reasons, that she needed to step away from that post. And she wanted to put my name into the hat as a consideration for her replacement. She called me up just as I was making preparations for my third space flight. It turned out to be my final flight. And I had reached the point, I was kind of realizing I was reaching the point where Earth was pulling me back. I had three great flights. I think I was so struck by the power of the space perspective, and as an Earth scientist, very aware of how the space vantage point gives us such a boost on how we can understand and monitor this planet. And what I really cared about in that vein was, how do you make that kind of tremendously valuable insight and information, how do you make it actually matter and be useful and be pertinent to life here on Earth? I don't want it just to be the spiffy astronaut vacation pictures that I brought home from my space flights.
What was your immediate impression when you saw the blue planet for the first time from outside of the blue planet?
It was truly breathtaking. I mean, it pulled the air right out of me, and I blurted out, I mean, it was 8.5 minutes after we lifted off and I got my first glimpse, and I couldn't help myself. I just, wow, look at that. It was not the right moment for that digression, but that's a separate point. The symptoms and signs of human life on the surface of the planet that you can see look like very faint little sketches on a very large planet.
The mapping of the seabed and the mapping of the oceans. Again, we have another question, I believe, on this one. And that is, only 6% of the entire ocean has been mapped, and there's an enormous amount we do not know. How do we learn more? That's a question from Lorcal O'Canaja in Dingle in County Kerry.
Yeah, it's a very good and a very important question, actually. There are a couple things that I think need to happen. One is, I mean, 6% takes a lot of ship time if you're measuring the bottom of the ocean by sonar from a surface ship. So we've got to begin to take better advantage of today's capabilities in autonomy and self-guided vehicles. And there's some very exciting new developments underway with ocean gliders and autonomous vehicles that you can program them, and they will go off underwater and do much more mapping in a concerted period of time than can be done from the surface ship. So we need to scale up to where we have fleets of these operating continuously throughout the ocean.
The destruction of the oceans, the destruction of marine life, pollution, it seems that even in the most exotic and distant parts of the oceans, we now find plastics. What are we to do?
Get radically better at controlling plastic debris, let it not come down in streams and run into the ocean. Another scale, the other end of the scale, the question is microplastics. And that is a much thornier, much, much thornier problem. I just saw a paper the other day reporting about microplastics in organisms in the very high Arctic that appear to have been transported there on particles, basically particles of rubber tires. So as tires are burnt in dumps down in the populated world, the mid-latitudes and tropics, some of that gets suspended in such fine particles that it can make it all the way up to Arctic latitudes before it settles out and gets deposited. So microplastics are a very thorny question that at present I don't think any of us have an answer to.
We all assume that the Earth is in some kind of perpetual stable state. We know about global warming and temperatures edging up, but how important are the oceans in terms of the provision of oxygen for us all to breathe?
The oceans are absolutely essential to how our planet works. They provide about every other breath you take, the oxygen every other breath you take. It's from the sea, from small organisms in the sea that are not the charismatic ones that end up on your restaurant plate. It's one of the major sinks for the heat that's already been generated in the atmosphere because of increasing CO2 concentrations. But that CO2 going down into the ocean changes the pH. It changes the acidity of the ocean. So you've got both in terms of the global warming and climate change challenge, yes, you've got the heating up of the oceans. The ocean has a heat sink, and that certainly can't be an inexhaustible heat sink either. How will that extra heat in the ocean affect the circulation of the ocean that moderates and sets our climate patterns? And then as the waters become more acidic, the small-scale creatures, the plankton, many of which make calcium shells as their homes, their calcium shells will become destabilized. They're at the bottom of the marine food chain. They start the whole cascade of life that becomes the fisheries that we think about or rely on, and they are the source of a lot of the oxygen in the ocean.
The other accolade, besides being the first American woman to walk in space, the other accolade is going to Challenger Deep. First of all, how deep is Challenger Deep? Where is it? And what was it like?
The Challenger Deep is at the southern part of the Marianas Trench, which is a big gash in the deep sea floor that arcs around the Marianas Island. It's about 200 miles southwest of Guam and about 600 miles east of the Philippines. Middle of nowhere kind of place. It's just shy of 11 kilometers deep. A spacecraft only needs to design for a pressure change of one atmosphere, from the one atmosphere pressure we have sitting here on Earth to zero outside. A submersible has to deal with one atmosphere pressure at the surface to whatever depth you're going to. The bottom of Challenger Deep, it's about 1,200 atmospheres. It's about 16,000 pounds per square inch. So the shape of your craft in that case wants to be a sphere. That's the strongest possible shape for such immense pressures. And in our case, with the limiting factor, which is the name of the submersible I was in, the sphere is about a meter and a half diameter, solid titanium. The walls are 90 millimeters or about 3.5 inches thick. And that's what lets it resist. I want all the heavy stuff outside, and I want just the same conditions I'm sitting in here to be safely preserved inside. It was a fascinating experience, but it's the only vehicle on the planet that can go to any depth in any ocean repeatedly.
What an extraordinary story, Kathy Sullivan. Thank you very much for taking us through an extraordinary life.